Well, hello there and welcome back. By now you know a little bit more about me and what I do here and why this topic and this class is so important to me. And now, by now you also have a sense of why you might be here. Perhaps you're even realizing that there are a few more things that might need to be addressed and that may have called you off balance a little bit now that we've gone through some of the criteria and the common things that I hear from people all the time about what brings them to the point where they realize they need to learn some new skills. So you have some idea about how you're going to show up for yourself, just like you show up for others every time those tones go off. And you have an idea about what it is specifically that you want to get out of this experience. So let's move on. This is still in week one, module two, gearing up for the challenge. So before we jump in and start working on and developing some new skills, we also want to talk a little bit about what is the situation that is currently facing men today. Why do I care so passionately about improving men's stress levels, improving men's health outcomes, helping men to feel better no matter what they do, if they're a first responder or an executive? So even though it's commonly known and we hear about it all the time, actually, in a lot of the political rhetoric as well, that men enjoy many more privileges than other groups of people, especially white men, right? These privileges, in terms of things like making more than women do and other sorts of power and privilege that we think of men having in our society, even though that is actually true, that type of advantage does absolutely not translate into better health outcomes. So while men have the ability to make more money than women do, for example, their health is actually much poorer. And I think it's really important when we think about this, not just because it's interesting research facts, but how these types of research findings translate in the everyday experience of you as you're walking around through your daily life. So why is it that men have poor outcomes? What the research has found, and what I'm about to share with you a little bit more in depth here, is that traditional masculine values, what it means to be a man in the world, to be a provider, to be the strong one, many of those qualities that we absolutely adore men for are actually detrimental to good health. So did you know that men in general, not first responders, men in general are 5 times as likely to commit suicide than women are, for example, and that they're 3 times as likely to have run-ins with the law? Now, maybe that's not you, because we know you're an upstanding citizen. You're likely, if you're listening to this, a public servant of some kind with a very clean history. But men in general are more likely to have run-ins with the law. Maybe you know some friends from school, some buddies you have. Maybe you even have some kids of your own that are running into some of these difficulties. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that men, even with all the privilege and making more money, are more likely to want to kill themselves or more likely to be getting arrested? Men also have a much lower life expectancy by at least 10 years by the accounts of the research, right, than women. Okay, so women are outliving men. Is this just a biological difference that we can't change just because of the chromosomes we have? Why is this? Many public health agencies, including the World Health Organization, has looked into this specific thing. Why is it that men are dying before women? Now, I'll tell you. One is men don't go to the doctor as often as women do, and they're much less likely to comply with the recommendations that their doctor will make once actually they do just finally decide to go to the doctor. Now, another example is married men live much longer than married women or single men. And why is that? Well, if you're coming home and you've got a wife nagging you to eat your broccoli and nagging you about that pain in your back that you keep not checking out and you keep kind of white knuckling through, and you go to the doctor, and then that doctor finally says, oh, hey, like, actually it's a this problem and we can do something about that, right? This is why. So married men and comply with medical recommendations better. They go to the doctor more often. Now, I'm not saying this so everyone runs out and gets married and that's going to make you live longer. No, that's not really the outcome I'm looking for here. But I do want you to understand that there is a reason why men struggle more with their health and their mental health than women. They take more risks. What does that mean? What is so fun sometimes about these traditional masculine values, the ones that, who's jumping out of airplanes, who's doing the risky skydiving, adventures, mountain hiking, you know, big treks, flying airplanes, driving motorcycles. Predominantly, when we see who's doing those activities, it's men, and those are just riskier. So what we know is men like to take more physical risks. They also, the research shows, take more drugs. Maybe that's not you. Maybe you've seen it in other groups that, of men that you know or you went to school with. So, the World Health Organization, this is the World Health Organization, often referred to as the WHO, addresses this specifically. They've known for years about these poor health outcomes of men. So, and they say this is due to several factors. One, men have a greater levels of occupational exposure to physical and chemical hazards. What does that mean? When you think about people in construction, in mining, in law enforcement, in the fire service, in occupations that put people in physical danger, who do we see dominating those? Exactly. We see men dominating those. So that means just by virtue of being in the line of fire, they're a little bit more at risk and their survival is on the line. We also see behaviors associated with male norms of risk-taking and adventure. It's normal, right? Man up, get out there, let's go do this, right? We got this, let's get out there. Let's, you know, do something a little dangerous, do something a little risky, have some fun in the process, because yes, it's also awesome and fun. I'm not saying please don't do those things. I love to do some things that get my adrenaline going as well, right? But those behaviors are associated with these male norms of risk-taking and adventure, which, you know, when something goes wrong in one of those risk-taking, cliff-diving kind of experiences, it's often a man who is suffering the consequences. Also, like I mentioned earlier, the World Health Organization specifically notes how much less likely men are to visit a doctor when they're sick. So a man who's feeling sick compared to a woman who's feeling sick is going to be the last one calling the doctor's office to follow up on their medical condition. And they're less likely to report. So just say they do say, or you do finally go to the doctor and you say, yeah, something's been going on, you need to check this out, doc, right? They're less likely to actually report the symptoms that they're actually experiencing. So they'll go, but they won't maybe report everything or specific symptoms they might leave out. And when we look at the health outcomes of men in general, we know that men experience depression and PTSD at higher rates than the general population. We know that men, and especially also firefighters, there are some specific studies about the fire service in this realm. 56% of firefighters have problem drinking behaviors. What are problem drinking behaviors? You might chuckle when you hear these actual official numbers, but problem drinking, binge drinking, for example, is 5 or more drinks on any one occasion. If you want to know what the official medical rule is around this. Now, some people think if I have 5 or more drinks on a Saturday night, that's just a rockin' Saturday night. But that's actually classified as binge drinking. It could also be more than 14 drinks a week. Okay, so that's what men often are experiencing, more substance abuse problems. and especially firefighters and first responders. Now, we'll talk about that coming up in a few minutes as well. Men are dying by suicide 3.5 more times than the rate that women die, right? Why is that? On average, there are about 123 suicides per day, and white males account for 7 out of 10 suicides in 2016, right? So white males, especially at high risk. Firearms account for about 50% of all suicides in 2016. This is the most recent data that I was able to find. And the rate of suicide is highest in white middle-aged men, right? A lot of times that looks and sounds like first responders, the fire service, the police force. So then let's take what we know about men's health outcomes in general, this dying sooner, not going to the doctor, not talking about the illnesses that they do have, and look at what then, how this might translate to public servants. There is some data that came out in 2017 about firefighters in particular, that suicide, when you look at the rates of suicide in firefighters over the last about 4 years versus the line of duty deaths, the suicide, more firefighters are dying by suicide than they are in the line of duty. And even many organizations talk about how that this is likely vastly underreported because suicide is often swept under the rug, not put on a death certificate. No one's talking about it. They'll make some other conclusion instead of saying suicide when everybody knows actually that that person had a very big hand in their own death, but nobody really wants to talk about it. So they're starting to see this trend, not only that suicide is more commonly the way that a firefighter is likely to die versus in the line of duty, but that these rates are growing exponentially to a point where the difference between those two numbers, the number of people that die in 2015, for example, in the line of duty versus suicide in 2015 is much greater. Like the graph bar of the number of people dying by suicide is much greater than it was in 2012. So this is a very disturbing trend. And I'm not talking about it just so we can have some academic knowledge, but I do really want to think about, maybe you're not thinking of killing yourself, but there are a lot of people that do think about it, people in the fire service, and when we already know that men kill themselves at higher rates than the rest of the population, and then we see the rates of what's happening in the world of first responders, it's something to take note about and think about how this culture, how being in this environment may be affecting you. So what we know about firefighters in particular is that 1 in 5 are gonna struggle with some sort of behavioral health issue in their career. Behavioral health issue can be anxiety, depression, a drinking issue. It can come in lots of different forms, an issue around substances or some gambling, kind of variable mood stuff going on, stress-related illnesses, but it's basically very common. And so I'm very glad that you're here, that you've put your hand up for needing some help. And I want you to know that I know you've been feeling alone, like you've been carrying this, that you're not allowed to talk about it, that it's shameful, or perhaps you have some guilt around how has it come to this, that you're needing extra help? And I just really want to put that to rest right now, because what the statistics show is if it's not you, it's the person sitting next to you who's struggling. It's the problem is that there's a culture of silence around it. And speaking of the person sitting next to you, when you're in the firehouse, when you're in a training, what the statistics are showing is that half, okay, 50% of all firefighters will think about suicide. 50. this number is astronomical. And that means if it hasn't been you, great, I'm glad for that. But if it's not you, it's the person sitting next to you. And it's often that people think, no, there's no way. I'm the only one who might be struggling, who's struggling right now. And that's just simply false. 20% of firefighters actually make a plan on how they might end their lives. And first responders in general attempt suicide 6 to 10 times more than the rate in the general population. This is a staggering, sobering statistic. And what we also know is that when they look at what first responders are saying, is that 92% in this particular study, 92% said asking for help, seeking treatment, putting your hand up and saying, you know, something's not right here. I need a little bit of coaching. I need a little bit of assistance. See that as a sign of weakness. 92%. And perhaps you can relate to that. Maybe you know you've been holding some stuff in for a really long time, and it's taken getting to a breaking point of when things actually got worse, really bad. Maybe it's a spouse telling you if you don't get better than XYZ, or it's your kids really saying daddy's always angry all the time, or you just feeling like crap when you know you're not enjoying life the way you used to. And of those, 7% throughout their career will actually attempt suicide. So these are really high numbers. And what the research is also saying is that they're vastly underreported. And it may be that this is only at the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we're really seeing. So when you think about yourself, when you think about your brothers and sisters that you work with, what are some of the things that you've heard or seen in your coworkers, in your colleagues that are having a hard time? How do you know, you know, being that we know that now there's this kind of culture of silence, of not talking about things, how do you know when things are, when someone isn't doing so well, right? What are the things that you're seeing? Maybe perhaps some of the things that people are telling you that they're noticing in you, right? Yeah, they just don't really seem the same anymore, right? You don't seem as jokey and funny as you used to. You don't come out and hang out as much as you used to, right? What are some of the signs and symptoms that you see in some people that you suspect may be having a hard time? And why is this? Why is this the silent epidemic of people struggling with some sort of behavioral health issue, of dealing with stress on the job, stress from home, stress from working with administration, whatever it may be? Why is it that men are dying and struggling at higher rates than women, for example? And it all comes down to what I mentioned before, masculinity, the code of masculinity, what it means to be a man, the messages that we get through TV commercials, through, you know, that's perpetuated through the fire service or through these cult department cultures, right? Why are so many people struggling? And while it is amazing, there are so many amazing qualities of what it means to be a man. We need them, right? When we think about what those qualities are, it's strength, it's assertiveness, it's leadership, it's courage, all these things that actually we adore, right? That we need in to do the job that you're doing, that we appreciate, right? But those amazing qualities are great in a certain role, but not all the time, right? Why are people ill-equipped to deal with this? Why are people struggling with their health and mental health down the line, right? It isn't because they're flawed in some way. You're not flawed in any way. It's not your fault if you're feeling a little off or stressed, right? Often boys and men are trained out of feelings at a very young age, right? And I know this is starting to shift a little bit, and it's probably different than the generations before, right? But there is this code of masculinity, of handling things on your own, of being calm and cool as a cucumber, right? Of being tough. And what's the message we often give to little boys? Like, boys, don't cry, right? Don't stop being a pussy. Don't be a sissy, right? And so if you are those things, right, that means you're a girl, right? Don't be girly, right? And Will's like, well, no, fuck no, I'm not a girl, right? I'm a man, and that means I don't show emotion, right? Don't show any weakness. Man up. All these kinds of messages that come at us in many different forms and through many avenues, right? Don't be too emotional, right? Don't be so sensitive, right? Have any of you guys heard that before? The messages start bombarding from childhood. If you just even look at childhood books, cartoons, all this stuff, it is coming. The messages are coming. And the message that is often portrayed is don't show emotion. Emotion equals weakness. And that is not being a man. Right? Vulnerability is kind of conditioned out of you, right? So it's not your fault. It's how you were educated. It has nothing to do with your own personal weakness. And even though it's not your fault, and it is the way that, you know, you were perhaps raised or the messages that came from society, it's not effective in getting you the life you want, in getting you the relationships you want, in creating a happy, healthy, emotional state of mind. So some of the research talks about the code, right? What is this code of masculinity? I mentioned a few of the qualities, right? And what are the rules associated with this code, right? So if we know the code is being powerful, tough, athletic, in charge, not showing any fear, being the protector, the decision maker, not to have any feelings, except for one, right? That's anger, right? Men are often allowed, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, to display anger. That's cool, right? But not other emotions, right? No tears, right? That's really difficult. They're taught to not show any pain, often to be aggressive, dominant, courageous, right? And these aren't bad qualities. There's a lot of amazing, great qualities in them. In some of the things I've described, but what are the rules? Don't be too loving. Don't be too caring. Certainly don't ask for help, because that would mean what? That you're weak, right? Always be in control. Don't be too committed. Don't show any weakness. Act like a man. Be a man. Man up, right? So there's that message that just is like, well, if I'm a man, it means I'm not showing any emotion, and that's where, or I'm not talking about any kind of perceived weakness, and that's where things start to go south. So what does it mean in your particular department, for example, if you think about your coworkers, the rules, the code of your department? What is that culture? What are those messages coming at you? Are they supporting your emotional health? Is it more of this kind of code of masculinity, oftentimes in law enforcement, in the fire service, these kind of paramilitary organizations, many of which people are actually veterans or still active in the military, right? These messages are even stronger than they might be for other civilian men, right? So what I'm going to ask you to do now, starting right now and in the weeks to come that we work together, is to put these rules and this code aside, put it on hold for the rest of the time that you and I work together, because they don't work. And if you want to get healthy, you got to put these rules to the side. We're going to break the rules. We need to get in there to see the emotions so that we can fix it, right? If we know our car isn't working and we see that little check engine light and we hear a little rattle in the engine, we know the car's got something going on, right? But we keep driving it, And we hear that rattle, we hear that rattle. Now we got the kids or a family member in the car and we're hearing that rattle and we're feeling even a little bit more nervous because what if something goes wrong? And now should you even drive, take that, you know, road trip over to visit your family because that rattle might is starting to sound a little louder, but ooh, maybe you can make it just, you know, another day because who has time to go, you know, go swing by the mechanic. That's the same exact way I want you to think about this. When we ignore that rattle, what happens, right? It rattles, rattles, rattles until one day the whole freaking car, like something falls out of, while you're on the road or something goes even more wrong. And that was completely avoidable if you had actually stopped taking the car to the mechanic earlier in the game, opened the hood, fix a little screw that got loose or adjust a little thing or replace the little belt that needed to be replaced and get back on the road functioning again. But often if we wait too long, then that one little belt that was off started affecting another system involved in the engine. And then before we know it, we've got multiple problems underneath the hood that could have been a little bit more effectively addressed had we opened the hood and just kind of looked at it a while back. Right? It's the same. So I want you to put all these rules and this code to the side while we continue to do this work together so that we can get under the hood and do the little tweaking of the belt and the screws that need a little replacing and shining up and get you back out there. And how do we do that? Right? What's the secret to starting this process? Right? One of the most important steps is having the courage to be vulnerable. Now, vulnerable is like a four-letter word for many people, especially people who are public servants and expected to be the strong one, to be the tough one, who are carrying forward these roles and responsibilities of what it means to be a man. So what do I mean when I'm talking about vulnerability? Because I don't want you to have this kind of knee-jerk vomit reaction when you hear a word like vulnerability. What does it even mean, right? Vulnerability is basically laying your cards on the table, showing your hand, being willing to take the risk to be exposed emotionally. Right? It is opening up the hood of the car and saying, you know what? Like, actually, I've been driving for a while without this belt even on. And I know it's kind of burning out this other part of the engine, but, you know, I could get by for a while. When we look at what the reason is and what happens in couples, for example, who end up on the path and on the road to being divorced, 80% of divorces are due to emotional distance. And what is it that when researchers have gone to these couples and interviewed the women, who, by the way, are typically the initiators of divorce, they say that, and this is both men and women will say that we just grew apart. Right? We just grew apart. We weren't connected anymore. Things, you know, we just drifted. And what is it that the women actually say that they needed? This emotional connection, which requires vulnerability to really know what's going on in someone else's heart. Does that mean you have to pour out all of the nitty-gritty detail of the crap you see when you're on the job? Absolutely not. It doesn't actually mean that. But it does mean that being willing to lay your cards out on the table, even though it's not intuitive, is actually gets you closer to what it is you want, right? There's a joke, right? And it's not even that funny because it's not even a joke, really. I think it's just reality. And you may have had this conversation, right? When women often need to feel emotionally close. And what does that mean? It actually means vulnerable, sharing feelings, putting their cards out on the table, sharing what it actually is happening in their heart in order to want to sleep with someone. Okay. Not everybody, but I'm speaking in generalizations, right? When it's their partner, it's like, I need that emotional connection before I can even go to kind of a physically intimate place with somebody. right? And that's what women often say they need. And it's kind of the opposite is often true for men, right? They need that physical connection in order to let down their guard and share their hearts. So that's often where relationships start to go south, is in that lack of vulnerability. So that it's not only in relationships with significant others, but also that willingness to be vulnerable with yourself, to share with whoever you're working with, whether it's me, whether it's in a class situation, whether it's in this stress management group, but being willing to share in this vulnerable, authentic way, because that's how we get to know what's going on underneath the hood and where we can make the repairs. And also there's something quite healing in sharing what's actually going on. Oftentimes people have been holding stuff for so long that it's a really heavy weight to be carrying. So I'm inviting you to kind of put that down. Vulnerability actually creates deeper and more real connection. And I know every single person listening to this right now is someone that has courage. And what is courage? What's the definition of courage, right? You can't be courageous if you don't confront something that scares you. Courage means having fear and doing it anyway. It's something you all do in your job, when you're on the scene, when the tones go off, when you need to respond to an incident, right? There's courage. You're kind of used to it, so you probably don't even think about it anymore because you've trained yourself to do it. But it means showing up. You maybe feel that fear of, oh shit, what am I walking into right now? I don't even know what's going to happen, but I know exactly how I'm going to show up, right? With courage, right? I'm willing to face the fear and do it anyway. So I'm asking you to bring that same attitude that makes you a great firefighter, that makes you a great police officer, and bring that here to this class as well. It also means not really giving a flying F about what other people think, right? Some of you guys might be good about having that attitude in other areas of your life. And I'm asking you to bring that same attitude and apply it to your emotional life as well. Because I guarantee you, if it's something you're feeling, you are not the first person to feel it. And for sure, if you're in this class, you are not the only person to feel it. So I'm inviting you to show up with courage and vulnerability as we move forward and learn some skills to deal with what's under the hood. So I want to tell you here a little bit about a guy I worked with. His name was Rob. Now, it wasn't until I met Rob that I truly saw how vulnerability played out in real time. Okay, so Rob was an older guy that I worked with while I was working at the VA. He's a Vietnam veteran era person, and he initially came to me because his medical doctor didn't know what to do with him anymore. So Rob had been complaining of insomnia, a bunch of physical pain going on, to the point where his hands were starting to curl up. And this was a guy that loved doing, he had a hobby of making bullets and things I don't really understand because I'm not a gun person, but perhaps you understand a little bit more. But he would go to gun shows. He had a habit of working with his guns and his bullets, and he needed his fine motor skills of his fingers. And because of his pain, his hands were starting to curl up, and he was having difficulty sleeping. Not only was there pain in his hands, but in his shoulders, in his back, in his hips. And most of his nights were spent flipping from one side until that became too painful, and turning over to the other side until that became too painful, and just struggling to get a good night's sleep. And over time, he started feeling pretty crappy. And the doctors couldn't figure anything out about really what his diagnosis was. They couldn't seem to identify anything. They put him through all sorts of tests, all sorts of drugs and med trials. Nothing was really working. And Rob was getting pretty down about life at this point. He was thinking, what's the point? He was an outdoorsy guy. I can't camp the way I used to. I can't engage in my hobbies. He loved his dogs. He couldn't walk his dogs the way he wanted to. He was married, and he was getting pretty grumpy with his wife, who was starting to notice. And all in all, life started to become a bit of a struggle. And so when his doctor threw his hands up, sent him to me and say, well, we can't figure it out medically. Why don't you go talk to the shrink? Right. So Rob comes to me and he tells me what's going on. And it wasn't until he was truly able to be vulnerable with me and himself that he was able to make a major change. So we began by learning some skills to manage his stress. And little by little, he practiced some of the exact same things that we will learn here in this class together. And his depression started lifting. He started sleeping better. We started changing some of his habits and managing his emotional state. No, were we fixing the problem with his hands? Absolutely not. But he started learning skills to address his overall stress level. And he joined a class just like this. And he started connecting with the other people in the class and forming new relationships, right? Because he had been kind of rattling around his house, feeling pissed off about all the things he couldn't do anymore. And he hadn't really been nurturing any new relationships. So after a few weeks, Rob's wife started, you know, joking with him about, well, he needed to go to the hospital to go, you know, have his date with his girlfriend, Margaret. And, you know, they were getting more playful at home and he was starting to feel better. And his pain was actually, as his stress level decreased, his experience of pain started to decrease. And after almost about a year of him checking in and starting, and really not starting, his depression had already gone away and he'd been practicing these skills for a while. He came in one day and he had kind of this, you know, heavy energy to him. And I was like, Rob, what's up? You know, at this point we're pretty close. And I know him pretty well. And, you know, we're pretty comfortable. And he goes, well, there's something I haven't told you. And I was like, okay. And I knew it was pretty serious, whatever it was. And he decided in that moment to share with me the gory details of what had happened in his military service that was all pretty top secret, not in his military record. And he shared that he had been a sniper and he had been specially commissioned because he was such a good marksman. And he had been this very kind of top secret sniper and killed 39 people while he was deployed or while he was in drafted. I don't know if he was drafted, actually. So while he was in his military service, he said, I killed 39 people. And every night when I close my eyes, I see every single one of their faces. And he said, and here's the problem. I was really good at it. And I actually enjoyed it. And now, you know, this many years later, I don't know, it's like 40 years later, I feel like crap. And I've been so ashamed and it's been a secret my whole life that nobody knows. And I need to talk about it, right? And it wasn't until that he laid his cards out on the table. And, you know, at this point, he's teary, I'm teary, because it's such a heavy, amazing moment between the two of us where he's really sharing his deepest pain in life, right? He had actually been estranged from his adult children up until this point. He had told me that he expected he would have been dead by this age. And he had lived hard after he had come back from Vietnam. All he did was drive his motorcycles fast and engage in a lot of risky behaviors and pull away from his wife at the time, not really engage in the way that he wanted to engage with his children. But he realized you know, after quite some time that he really needed to put that down, put his secrets down, speak what was really happening in his heart. And even though he had experienced a decrease in depression and decrease in his pain up until that point, when he was able to do that, his stress and pain and depression went completely away. Completely away. What we started doing was getting right in there and dealing with the memories and dealing with the things that were popping into his mind every time he closed his eyes. And it was at that point that he got really the help that he needed and began to make peace with some of the things he had seen and done. See, we all have that tendency to hold our cards close to our chest. Right? It's not just him. This isn't unique to him and some soldier war story, right? We all have the tendency to do that, to only let other people see the parts of ourselves that we want them to see and not to share what's really going on, what's really happening in our heart of hearts. You know, we want to put a brave face on. We don't want to burden other people either because it's overwhelming for ourselves or because we're trying to protect the people we love. We're taught not to show any emotions or not to show anything that actually might be perceived as quote unquote weak, right? And sometimes we get so good at that that actually we don't even know what's going on with us. We get so good at going through the motions. We get so good at just attending to the daily tasks and the daily routine of life that it catches up to us at some point or another. And perhaps you have had this experience yourself. So my question for you is, what are you holding back? Where in your life are you not vulnerable? I'm not saying everyone needs to walk around spilling their guts all over the place to everyone that crosses their path. No, not at all. But if you were really open and honest about what's going on with you, what might happen? What are you afraid of that might happen? So I really want you to take a moment here and think about the parts of yourself that you don't show other people, and especially the parts of yourself that you don't show the people closest to you, right? Maybe you're not showing everything all the time at work, and I totally get that, but your family members, the people that deeply, deeply love and have genuine concern about your well-being, regardless of what job it is you do. What parts of yourself do you hide? What parts of yourself do you share? And how do you edit that yourself? Because it's not about being weak, right? It's not about not being tough enough or being a failure because you might be feeling an emotion like sadness or guilt or shame about something you've seen or experienced, right? It's not, and it's certainly not about letting anybody down. If you're not right, your community isn't right. If you're not right, the people you serve feel it, right? If you're not right, your relationships, your marriage, the relationship you have with your kids aren't right either, right? Your kids absolutely feel it. You think you hide it from them. Okay, yes, maybe certain things are hidden, but do they know when their parent is present or not? Hell yes, they do know. Do they know when dad's irritable because he's stressed out from work? Even though they're not saying anything, and even though you're not saying anything, and you're still sitting at the dinner table like you do every other night, they feel it. So ignoring your stress to help everyone else or to protect other people simply is an ineffective strategy. As people who don't ask for help lose marriages and families, they lose their relationships with their kids. They suffer. Those relationships suffer. And eventually, often, they lose doing the work that they really are driven in a deep way to do, right? I know each one of you listening to this is very mission-driven and are deeply committed to service, putting your lives on the line for that sake of that service. And when we're not saying, hey, I need some help, hey, this is what's really going on with me, right? Eventually we burn out, the well runs dry, you know, we're out of gas, right? The bank account, the emotional bank account is empty. We have zero resources left to do the work that we're put on this earth to do. People feel, start losing their own confidence in their ability to be a solid human being, to be the person that they thought they were. Right? They lose their ability to enjoy life. And what are we here for if we're not going to actually have some fun in the process? So helping other people at the expense of yourself is honorable. The community thanks you for your service. I thank you for everything you do to make our community healthier, safer, cope better with the shit that goes on out there. But it's unrealistic to do that at the expense of yourself day in and day out. You simply, if you want to be a better public servant, you have got to address the parts of yourself that are off balance. In order to serve others, you have to take care of yourself as well. So let's pause here and let's do a little exercise. So if you need to pause this recording, please get a piece of pen and a piece of pen. Please get a pen and a piece of paper or whatever journal or writing notebook you're using for our work together. If you need to pause this and go grab it and then come back, please do that now. Otherwise, I want you to take out your piece of paper and I want you to make two columns, okay? And on the left, on the top of that column, it's what you show the world, right? The qualities, the person you are, those things that you do show the world. And on the other side, on the right side, that right-hand column, parts of yourself that you hide from the world. And maybe it's from your family, from your coworkers, from your children. I want you to get real clear about the distinction between how you show up, what you show other people, and what's actually the parts of yourself that you hide from those same people. And I'm not talking about necessarily when you're out on calls, but mostly the people that are close to you, your friends, your family, your buddies. What are the parts that you actually don't share? So let's just take a few minutes, do that, get clear on the parts of yourself that you don't share with other people and the parts that you do, and join me for the next module.